Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to Morelia Python Radio. Tonight we have on Don Patterson. He's calling in from up north, and we're going to be talking some carpets and snake breeding business and such. What's going on, Owen?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
So yes, exactly. That is what.
You
good night, everyone.
This is a radio show and not a TV show, right? You have to
shut up. Shut up. I am so unbelievably tired because I've been running downstairs and checking on little babies coming out of their little eggs the past 3 days. And we finally got them all out last night. And I get to marvel at the wonders of Carmel tigers sitting in my little basement room. So,
cool.
Yes, they're gorgeous. And I'm teasing everyone because I have not put pictures up, and I am the only one who's seen them.
Yeah, you jerk.
I have people texting me, put the pictures up yet? I'm like, no, I didn't take the pictures. I will take pictures eventually. So it's definitely excited to see these guys, and I promise I will get pictures, but I do not have a camera, and I don't really want to take pictures on my phone and, you know, put them out there for people to be like, oh, could have been better. But,
I suck at pictures.
I know.
I really do.
I know you do. But the interesting part is, like, I've talked with, you know, Jason Balin, with you, with a few other people, and, you know, what we can expect for, like, with Carmel tigers. And I was actually very pleasantly surprised. We have a lot of girls, and a lot of them actually have striping down their dorsal. One in particular has excellent striping down the dorsal and the sides, but I hate to say that she's mine. All of you can back off and go to hell. She's mine. and there's some of them that look fantastic. And there's one already. And, you know, it's just something that I'm pretty sure we can all look at. It's the prettiest one in the group, and it has the nastiest attitude out of all of them. All the little babies are curled up, huddled in the corner. This one's sitting right up, trying to bite me in the face as I'm looking at them all. And I'm like, really? Really? But you're so pretty. So,
yeah.
Either way, whatever. So how are things going on at your place?
Yeah, pretty good. I just spent the day cleaning today and getting everybody fed and getting ready for next year, pretty much.
I haven't heard any stories about you, like, pulling your hair out with these feeding trials of babies, so I'm assuming everything's going okay. Have there been ones that have kind of made you want to scream?
Actually, no.
Jesus, you got it easy, you bastard. So, I mean,
yeah,
my first year, there were 10 babies. They were like, no, I don't want food. So I'm like, I'm doing it wrong. So.
Well, I can tell you this, and I don't know if this has anything to do with it, but you know how I'm sort of follow that heat tape method, especially with the babies. They're just in the room. They're at 82 degrees. No issues. They're not on any heat tape, though, so I don't know if that has anything to do with it. I don't know.
And see, I've heard the reverse, that babies prefer temperatures close to the 90s when they first get out.
Yeah, I remember when I first bought actually it was an IJ, and I remember I was having trouble getting it to go, and for whatever reason, I raised the heat a bit, and it ate right away. But these are just the opposite. I don't know. I don't know. Luke was saying that he was having some trouble with because you know this is the parents that he had, but he was having some trouble with them once they relocate. Once they relocate to another, you know, once people sold them, then they had trouble eating. But I don't know. I don't know, but it's working, so I'm going with it.
Yeah. Nothing is wrong, so I'm just going to keep going. Okay.
Yeah.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. So, that's pretty much it. I'm just getting them going. Surprisingly, there's a lot of variety in the Red Tiger Zebra Jag clutch. Which is really starting to show because the babies are on their second shed. The Red Zebra is really taking on that. The Red Zebra's taking on, the Red Tiger look.
Yeah.
It's really taking on that color. You know, like in the middle stripe.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
kind of the color of the zebra, which is pretty cool. And then there's another one that's totally opposite in there.
Oh.
Yeah, and then the jag, I have a jag that I guess is going to be more towards like a jungle jag type with solid black saddles. And then there's another one that has solid red saddles. And it's like red,
why
almost
not?
Like, no, well, not quite that red, but, you know, it's in that vein. So
why not? Just, have all different varieties. Speaking of variety in zebra, did you see what Precision threw up on Facebook?
Yes, the Exanic Zebra.
That's an Exanic Zebra. That is gorgeous. And it's a slimy, ugly baby coming out of the egg, and it's gorgeous. Of course, it's a gray and black baby, but it's a zebra baby. I mean, and I can't wait for this thing to color up, because if it gets that silver and that black, it's going to look gorgeous. And then, of course, the second round of this is, what happens when you cross two Exanic Zebras?
Well, I was thinking about that, and, you know, I know I was reading a post and somebody said that it was going to be an all-black snake, but I would think it would be an all-silver snake.
I would say I think it would be all silver.
Yeah. You know, like...
Silver is the color, because, you know, it's got normal zebras yellow and black. Cross them together, they're not an all-black snake. It's the yellow that comes through, so I think it's silver.
Yeah. So. I don't know. Should be cool, though.
Yeah, I'm sure Ollie over at Precision will do that in a few years and have us all being like, son of a bitch. One.
He also hatched out a caramel granite, too. I don't know if you saw that.
I did not.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was pretty cool.
See,
so, yeah.
Matt, you have all the tools for all these.
Yep.
To work.
Yeah, right.
What
I think I'm
going to
try
for?
My hand at I got to make hets first, but caramel granite hets next year. So, so we shall see. We
along
shall
with your snows and stuff, let's get the big book of carpet breeding. What I call your magic tome that you write down all your breeding stuff in, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
I know it's probably just like a normal marble notebook, but I imagine this giant leather-bound book. So it takes up the size of a desk that you write with a quill in. So.
Yep.
Well,
how did you know?
I just kind of guessed, and it seems
it has
to fit, so it works.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, why not? But also, I know the fun things keep happening on Facebook. Kurt, I can't really say his last name, he's having a contest on his Facebook page.
Yeah.
You saw that, right? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Where it was, if you join his Facebook, you get... Did he announce the prize yet? I think it was like a Iron J Jag.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. I can't remember. Yeah.
I don't remember. I barely know what I'm doing half the damn time. but that was what he was saying, and they were apparently giving us a wonderful shout-out saying that Morelia Python Radios does rule, and something about the what we have here, it says people tune in forever via iTunes, but anybody who claims to be into Morelia should definitely listen to Eric and Owen. They certainly do rock, so... Yeah, that we rock.
That's cool.
Yeah. So thank you very much for your praise, and God help you for listening to us and enjoying it. But anyway, I digress.
Yeah.
So,
I think that was a pretty cool idea that he had to try to, promote, his business there. So.
Tip the scale in my favor for this IJJ. I may have been doing that.
I do like the picture that he has with all the snakes on it. If that was a poster,
yeah,
that would be badass. That's really cool.
I can never do a group shot like that because I put all my snakes together and like one would bite the other and be like, no, stop it, oh God. And then some would bite me. And I just imagine it would never go well for me. So...
Yeah, I think they probably did that though with just using editing though, don't you think?
Oh yeah, probably.
Yeah.
That makes more sense. Shut up.
It's okay.
That's enough. don't you do that.
Yeah. I guess I don't really have anything else.
No, we're gonna shut up and bring Don on real quick now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, Don, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Thanks a lot for having me on tonight.
Absolutely.
No problem, Don. So, Don, we always kind of work into the whole deal with the reptiles. Like, everybody knows that you're huge into reptiles, but now we want to know what got you into reptiles in the first place.
Yeah, no problem at all. I guess, like we've all heard before with all of us, that are into this so heavily and, breeders that do this for full-time living or part-time living or big collections. It's just, I guess, the love of animals since I was a kid. It's always been catching newts and frogs and snakes and bugs and crows. And if it moved, I wanted to look at it, pet it, collect it,
Awesome.
And it just went from there. And I guess the reptiles in specific was, the ease of care. They're just, when you're young, and it's pretty easy to keep newts and little lizards and frogs and stuff compared to, all the other things, which you can't even catch. So I guess that was the main thing. Easier to sneak into your room.
They don't make noise. You can hide them there. I understand that one firsthand. Yeah.
Frogs are breeding or something. Yeah, so. Mm-hmm. And I also had a really cool, my mom was really cool. She was, totally open to me keeping whatever animals I wanted as pets. And my mom, when she was a kid, she told me that her parents, my grandparents on my mom's side, never let her keep pets. They were, kind of strict. So she said to her parents when she was a kid, well, when I have kids, my kids can keep anything they want, any pets. So I guess, unfortunately for her, that happened. So I don't think she realized what she created exactly.
Yeah, she's got herself into there.
Yeah, and I think the whole sort of dinosaur, most kids love dinosaurs. I think that's just a fact of life. I couldn't tell you why, but I guess it's just so interesting that kids love dinosaurs. We won't get into what we learned as kids in school, how it was all wrong compared to what they know today. But anyway, now I digress.
Yeah.
But I guess just that whole the dinosaur connection, right? Just these reptiles are just, remnants of dinosaurs. It's amazing. So.
That's cool.
And then the other part of it is God only, who knows why we love them. We just do. Why do bird people go to birds and everything else? But yeah, no, reptiles is just, have total control of my whole life.
Awesome. Now, what was your first reptile that you were keeping? Just the newts in your room?
Probably the first would have been as a kid. We have alligator lizards up here. They're called northern alligator lizards. They're kind of related to skinks. They're a, Gerasaurus or something. I think it means lateral fold, sort of skinky lizard thing. And so, yeah, that would have been the first. And actually, unbeknownst to me, one of the ones I caught and kept as a pet was actually gravid. So I remember in the fall, because I used to let them go too, right, before I used to keep them over the summer. And this is going back a long time. I was just a kid. This is like in the 70s. And it was gravid. So one day I came home from, you know, like school, and there was like 10 babies running around my cage. And I thought someone had, it's kind of funny. It took me forever to figure out what the hell happened. I thought for sure my brother caught a bunch, or someone threw a bunch of lizards in the cage. Where'd they all come from? I just, you know, I don't know. Never flew through. It could have been gravid. So that was cool.
Threw together. Awesome.
So I didn't breed them, but I helped gestate them, you know.
Yeah. Hey, sometimes you get lucky and the one you've got is gravid. I mean, who knows?
I know. It happens now today with guys, people who buy wild-caught animals, you know, today, whether it's a lizard or a snake or whatever. It still happens, you know.
True. Yeah, I mean, it happens with people buying non-wild-caught. Sometimes you just get it and
the guy
tried breeding it. It didn't go, and then you get a clutch, and then the guy who sold it to you is kicking himself down the road a little bit, but, you know.
No, and you know what? It's interesting. I've actually seen animals for sale, and I'm already, you know, I'm looking at the ad and the price, and I'm thinking, man, I think I'm going to email this guy. I might want to buy this snake. And then at the bottom of the ad, oh, I've bred it with this and this for the last 2 months. Nothing's happened, but I need to sell it for money. And when I see that, I don't even want the animal now, because it's like, no, I don't, you know what I mean? I bought that. I would want to get that animal for a specific reason. Then you see they bred it.
Not
you know, you bought it for something
that,
cool, and then they bred it to a male coastal, and you're just like, oh, no.
No. Mutt babies.
Oh, well, keep looking. Exactly.
Yeah. So what brought you to pythons? What got you into pythons specifically?
I guess it was probably the head shape and the heat pits. Is just, I mean, initially when I wanted, basically it was like a year or two after getting out of high school, I was like, I'm going to do reptiles. And I was really into boas as well. And when I first started collecting, I was 50-50, boas and pythons. I had true red tails. I had emerald tree boas. I had rainbow boas. I had Dumeril's boas, as well as all the pythons I had. But I think what it was, in my eye, the pythons just had a way better variety. And once I got my first carpet python, which was a male coastal in like, God, it was like 1991 or 92. I'm kind of guessing here. I'd never seen one in real life. I mean, we're talking Western Canada. There's nothing around. So there's just this one guy I knew who got cool stuff up from the U.S. every once in a while, and he got me one. And when he sent it to me, or actually went over to his place to pick it up, and when I pulled it out of the bag, I could not believe the face, the heat pits, the shape of the head, the scalation, the velvetness. I was just, that was it. Once I saw that face, it was just like, Morelia is like, man, these are the coolest freaking snakes ever. They blow every other boa. They blow every boa away, and they a lot of pythons too. And then I guess after that, there's the variety. I mean, you just look at a map. If you had a book on pythons on Indonesia and Australia, it's just there's so much variety. It's just in carpets alone.
That is
true. Forget all the morphs, because back then there wasn't really much going on, especially in carpets.
Mm-hmm.
The localities, I mean, you know, the difference of you know, crazy coastals to high yellow jungles to diamonds, which weren't even obtainable back then, to bredli, which were, you know, only in books. Yeah, it was just, oh, my God, there's just so much stuff.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that I love most about Morelia, you know.
do you remember
such
the
a variety.
First time, I mean... Yeah, but do you remember the first time you saw a Morelli in real life? Was it the heat pits and head? The head and the heat pits and the nostrils? And when I first saw mine, I thought it looked like a skeleton, the skull, like the head shape and pattern, black and white. It looked like an outline of a skeleton or something. It was a skull, you know? It was just an incredible snake.
Yeah. It is. It was definitely very cool, I think, from the first time. Kind of knock you off your socks.
Yeah, and then later on when they're perched up, you know, you have all your other snakes hidden in the hide box, but your carpet's up on a perch, you know, and you're like, wow, you come into your snake room or your room or whatever you had, and, you know, it's cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. So what different species are you working with currently?
Well, I'm going to use the BP words. Let's all sit down and calm down. I definitely, you know, I do have a lot of ball pythons, and I won't hide the fact that I do love them. But I also have quite a few carpets, not as many as I used to have, because I can kind of specialize in some of the more expensive morphs and stuff, which is cool. So we can talk about those. And I also have Angolans. I love to death my Angolan pythons. I have a few chondros, not as many as I used to. I have diamonds, although I've kind of re-got into them, and What the heck else do I have? Oh, ring. I also bought a pair of ring pythons off of a friend of mine.
Ooh,
and
pleasure.
That's probably the bulk of it now. A lot of sort of the, how would I put it, the sort of outside stuff that was real fiddly to work with and a pain in the butt over the last several years, I've kind of got rid of slowly. And it's just, and I've sort of discussed this before with people, it's kind of one of those business decisions. When you do this full time, you really have to,
mm-hmm.
you have to be kind of militant about what you want to keep, because some of the stuff you like, but let's say the babies are really difficult to work with, or they're just difficult to breed with, or they just don't sell well, or
mm-hmm.
the babies just die for no reason. You know, there's certain species that you get to a point where, you know, you just can't afford to do it. And it's difficult when you do this full time to have stuff for fun. I guess for some
right.
of the breeders that are even bigger, if they have paid staff, then it's probably not so bad, because they've got guys in there all day. Whether if there's 1,000 snakes or 5,000 snakes, it doesn't really matter. But for when you do this all by yourself, you have to be really on the ball with what you want to keep and what makes sense,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's kind of the price you pay. But it's, you know, whatever, that's the way it is. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm keeping reptiles. How can I go wrong?
Yeah.
Right, yeah, well, good point.
What?
You know,
when was go ahead.
I was going to say, I've kept lots of other stuff in the past, though, but go ahead. It sounds like you had a cool question.
I was going to say, when did you decide, like, what... How did you just, jump in, you know, I'm going to breed reptiles and just, you know, put your collection together, or did you have
yeah,
the collection already?
And I went out and robbed a bank, stole credit cards. No, it was, I mean, I would have, if I had the money, I would have jumped in, but basically I just started waddling and then walking and then, you know, gradually worked up to a run, you know, just walk before you run kind of thing. So it was just a very slow, gradual progression. I mean, basically I got started right out of high school. The first thing I got probably right after high school was leopard geckos. And in those days, there was just no information. I mean, the internet didn't exist. The books were horrible. Western Canada, there was practically no reptile breeding, no way to get... So I had these leopard geckos, but I didn't even know how to sex them. I just assumed if I bought four, I'd end up with a pair somewhere. And I didn't. They're all females. They never bred. I know. It's so laughable now. You know, information, just like a little bit of information can be so important.
Yeah.
Anyway, so...
Everything would have been fine.
But again, that was part... You know, and in the meantime, I had day geckos and chameleons. And then I just said, I want a snake. And I think my first snake was a berm. And you'll love this. It died on me within like 3 weeks. I killed a berm. How does someone do that? It was a
wow.
red, beautiful, healthy berm. And I did nothing wrong. I don't know what I did. It just... I guess it was a crappy one or just... I don't know.
Right.
So, and then after that, it just, you know, I was working in a pet store, so, you know, my as soon as I got that shift of snakes, it just snowballed, and every time I would just save my paychecks and just keep buying animals, and just slowly work at it, and just gradually, I just gradually built up a collection, and I think by 94 was my, so I started probably building my collection in 1990, 1991, 94 was the first year of production. I had
mm-hmm.
surnames, pure surnames, I had rainbows, and I had coastals. That was my big year. And once I had those first clutches of babies, then it all changed, because then I actually had some serious income. Because before
mm-hmm.
that, it was like, you know, just like pet store hours, you know, like $6 an hour, $5 an hour, whatever the hell it was back then. I don't even remember. So
uh-huh.
I just chipped away. I just lived, you know, people call me... Don't call me Scottish as a joke. I mean, I lived extremely frugally, and just every penny. I didn't have anything. Everything I owned was crap, because every penny went into this. You know, every time I had money, bought more snakes. Every time I bred snakes, sell the babies, buy more cool snakes, and just kept building up and kept building. And it took a long time doing it that way. You know, it took a real long time. But, you know, there wasn't a lot of information back then. You know, and you got to remember, back then, you know, in the 90s, a lot of breeders kept everything a secret. There was no internet. There was no... The only thing available back then was Reptiles magazine, and it was just getting started. And I don't think the first issue was probably till like 94 or something, or 93. And there wasn't much info. It was more like a showcase thing. So, yeah, it was just, you know, just keep working at it and going and going and going. A lot of mistakes
yeah.
were made, I tell you that. A lot of dumb, dopey things. And I know I'm not alone in that one. I know there's a lot of people out there who've been
doing
it for a long time. They're just like, yeah, you know, he's not the only one. And a lot of things, you know, a lot of years, a lot of things never pan out. You know, you get a wicked clutch of eggs, they all croak, or the best babies in the litter, or clutch or litter, die for no reason, or the sex ratio is all screwed, you know, just stuff like that. It's, yeah,
mm-hmm.
it's tough. But, you know, you guys, I don't have to tell you guys because it's in your blood. If you love this, you love it. It's insane.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you find that does that play any part in losing your passion for it? Because I hear sometimes people, you know, if they do it full time, that they kind of their passion for it kind of goes away because, you know, you're relying on the clutch of eggs to pay your bills, you know. So
definitely there's a component to that, but now I'm going to sound all zen on you, but it's definitely important from my point. Like, number one, I'm, you know, I don't have, like, some people say, oh my god, this guy's been keeping and breeding since the early 90s. It's now 2012, and like other breeders way below me have like surpassed me with huge collections. But mm-hmm. my main goal was to keep sane and do this. I never wanted employees. I never wanted to be, like, so stressed out with so many animals and so much going on. I didn't even know if I was coming or going. So I specifically tried to fine-tune everything and remain small and profitable. And I've always tried to maintain that. And I think that's kept it fun so that when I wake up in the morning, I'm always excited to go downstairs and see what eggs are hatching, what eggs are being laid, what's breeding, did something eat, did some new snake I hatch out have its first shed. You know, those things still, I still get excited about it. But at the same time, yeah, sometimes I do get burned out. And, you know, it's really tough when crappy stuff happens. Like, let's say you're breeding a clutch of snakes and you hatch out a bunch of stuff that you don't want. Let's say you're trying to make a double morph of whatever mutation, mm-hmm. and you don't get it, and you get a bunch of normals or something. And sometimes I do kind of step back and, you know, you're all pissed off and depressed and frustrated and, you know, because it's money you're losing. But, you know, and you don't appreciate the animals for what they are sometimes. Like, it's a beautiful little baby carpet python. Look how gorgeous that thing. Who cares? It's just a coastal or just a jungle. Be happy you got that.
Right.
So sometimes I have to kind of smack myself in the head and say, you know, look, dude, fuck, get your shit together.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
That's a cool snake, you know. So I definitely am guilty of that, definitely. And I try and keep that in check. But, it's just I have a lot – there's a lot of people I know that don't do this full time, and they have to go to crappy jobs every day.
That would be
and
me.
They're not making, and they're not.
That would be
and,
me.
You know,
yeah.
some of them have good jobs, and some of them don't make much money. The shit they have to deal with, that kind of really, I really pay attention to that. I really try, and you know, when I talk to my friends and buddies, I that really keeps me things real for me. Like, dude, you got it lucky.
Yeah.
You know, and I've had crappy jobs, and so I know what the real world's like. So, but it's weird because you really, I mean, my friends always laugh. I'm kind of a hermit, you know. They call me the you know, the yellow brick road. The crazy guy behind the curtain all the time because I basically just live in my basement all the time. People don't come. I mean, you know, friends can come over much, but I'm so far in Western Canada. You know, I don't have a lot of friends. I mean, I have friends, but I don't have a lot of reptile friends that come here. They're all over the world.
Right.
You know, I've got good reptile friends in the U.S., good reptile friends in Germany and England, and customers in Asia and all across Canada. But, you know, but there's not like, you know, I have reptile. I have a couple, but not a lot. And they're so busy. We're also busy doing reptile stuff. So if we have free time, we often don't want to socialize reptiles, you know?
Yeah.
That's probably a good key thing is when you do go socialize, don't socialize too much in reptiles because, you know, you do it all day. But as I say, I love it. You know, I like being self-employed. I think if I didn't do this, I'd have to do something that I was self-employed.
Right.
Yeah. Hopefully one day I'll get there.
Hey, I don't. You know what? I think it's, I some people sort of say it like they think they might not be able to, but I think if you just start out slow and gradually build it, you can do it. I mean, I think it would be really hard if you had a well-paying job, because it would be a tough decision. But I don't know. I there's definitely it's totally possible. I just you know. Unless you're somehow your energy expense. I mean, if they do it in Europe, I think you can do it anywhere in North America, because it's way more expensive in Europe to do it. Energy fuel is way more expensive.
Right.
Don't worry, Eric. You can. I'll hire you to work here with me. You can clean my cages.
You know what? I think a lot of people have gotten started. You know, you hear it. I remember in the day, you know, when I had friends go visit Eugene Bessette or the Barkers and stuff. I think there's a lot of people that, I don't know if they did it through university or working at zoos, but they actually went and, you know, sort of understudied or did volunteer work with Eugene and the Barkers at VPI and stuff. And I think a lot of them, some of those, I'm guaranteed became full-time breeders.
Oh, cool.
There you go. I got cages clean. Get over here.
Oh, man. Well, I mean, the past couple of years, I'm kind of like you, Don. The past couple of years, I've just invested a ton of money into carpet pythons because...
Really?
I just love them. That's number one.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm just like, you know, do I want to do this for real or do I want to just kind of do this for fake, you know, and this for fun. I mean, you know, it's like, and
not really breeding the Kermit python.
Yeah.
We're just pretending.
Well, you know what I mean.
Kind of pretending.
Like,
those are rubber eggs in the cage. I just threw them in to see what a breeding like.
Yeah, exactly.
But, it's all a sham. Eric has no stakes whatsoever. It's all a lie.
But exactly, you know, I mean, it's like, I don't know, it's, you know, it's, I just figured, yeah, I'm jumping into the deep end of the pool and going to go for it. And
oh,
you know.
I think that's a great way. And like I told you, if I could have done that, I would have. Like, let's say I had a relative die and I was left a ton of money, or, you know, something had been different back then, I absolutely would have bought, you know, I would have dived in. It just, that was not available. That money was not there. I had to, you know, just gradually keep working. But I think the big change for me was as soon as I started producing babies. Because then you have, if you're working and producing babies, then basically it's like two income streams. And then you're, you know, God, I'm sounding all like money-oriented. I don't mean to sound that way, but it's true. Then you have more money to play with, or you have money for your own life and things you're interested in, and then you have the animal money that you can keep reinvesting. And that's sometimes the best way to go.
Yeah, it's kind of the way I'm at now, and then hopefully maybe in a couple years, you know, I'll have enough money saved up to where I was thinking if I had what I make a year now saved up that, you know, I would have a cushion, so to speak, some type of cushion where, you know, if I didn't get a clutch of eggs or whatever, you know, I wouldn't feel that pressure.
And you could always, there's always part-time work. I mean, I think we've all worked shitty jobs part-time while we do our whatever business we're getting started. And even if it sucks, it might only be for a year or two, and then you're done. You know, it's that little, it's just that little sort of, that little step to help you get to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That last little hurdle, that little cushion to help you through to get through to the final step of being full-time doing this. But,
yeah.
Well, definitely.
So let's talk about some of the carpets that you are working with. What types do you have?
Well, not as many as I used to because I, years ago, invested so heavily in the albino project.
Okay.
So that kind of took a lot of, that took a lot of time, a lot of money, and that really sucked up a lot of stuff. So, in, you know, and sort of in, because of that, it's sort of been like, well, I'm going to maximize, you know, I have no choice. I mean, it, you know, limited to be buying all this other cool stuff because of the albino stuff. So that's really my main carpet concentration of sort of energy and breeding has been with the albino project, 100%.
Okay, cool. And are you breeding other stuff into the albino, like albino jags or granites?
Yeah,
or?
I'm definitely doing it. So I have jag het albino. Last year I used, I did het to het, I did jag het to het, and het to jag het, various breedings. And then this year I did the same, but I also had one of my albino males, one of my, God, this is, these years get so confusing. So it would have been a 2010 male, so he would have been about 18 months. Yeah, he started breeding for me this late winter. So I also got to use an albino male on het females and jag het females for a couple clutches.
Nice.
Did it kicked in last minute. So, yeah, it was a lucky bonus. And one depressing thing was he also, I had a granite jag female.
Okay.
I raised up slow, hatched it out myself, beautiful animal, and I always fed it slow, I just was cautious with her. I don't really know why I was. I just thought, well, rather than feed the hell out of her, I'll just take it easy. And I didn't really want to breed her this year. She definitely had size and body weight, but then she started to swell up. Like, I knew something was happening. She was always in the cold end and curled up, and I was like, damn it, you're building follicles. I'm like, oh, well, this is ridiculous. I'm not going to waste this opportunity. So I threw the male albino in, thinking that, you know, he's pretty young, but sure enough, he bred her. So I was really excited.
Oh,
anyway,
wow.
Yeah, so I was like, oh, my God, if I'm lucky, I might hatch out jag or triple hets, you know, albino granite jags, right? A het for albino granite jag. Plus, everything else would for sure be a double het albino granite. So I was really excited, but unfortunately, it was kind of a disaster.
Oh, no.
No.
Yeah, luckily I saved her, but she got egg bound.
Ugh.
Oh, wow. Why do you think that happened? Too small?
I wish I knew. Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, So I didn't know until I got the eggs out of her, and I'll tell you how I did it, so maybe it helps someone out. I can say exactly what I did. So she was egg-bound, and I knew the day she was supposed to lay, she was egg-bound, because I could see here, the contractions weren't super obvious, but they definitely were contractions.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, okay, well, there's not, I mean, I've had a lot of experience, not a lot of egg-binding experiences, but I've had a few, enough to sort of have a good idea what's good to do and not what's good to do. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to leave her alone. And sure enough, I sort of kept watching her. And, you know, at first you're not sure. You think, well, maybe she's just trying to lay. Maybe the first egg's a slug, and, you know, over the next day or two, she'll be able to get it out and then get the good ones out. Anyways, days went on, nothing happened. In the end, there was only 5 eggs in her. So why did she get egg-bound with only 5 eggs?
Huh.
I mean, now, the eggs were big. Even by carpet standards, they were big. So could she have been too small? Yeah, I suppose that could have been a reason. She had good muscle tone. She was just an awesome snake. Anyway, I got her to eat, funnily enough, last night. She ate for the first time since I saved her.
Oh, thank God.
Oh, cool.
Really happy, yeah. So nothing new to the world of snake health, what I did to her, or snake science, is I aspirated the egg, which I'd never done before because I've usually been able to avoid that. Normally, in the past, it's very rare that I've had an animal go into laying eggs at the set day, you know, between day 25 mm-hmm. and day 30, be it a ball python, carpet python, chondro, whatever. Usually, I've never had a snake go to lay eggs and not be able to lay any eggs, like not even the first egg. I've had them lay, you know, a portion of the clutch and then get egg-bound.
Right.
But I've never had a snake, like, not even be able to get the first egg out. So, and that kind of threw me off in exactly what I would do. So, basically what I did is I was kind of, like, a little bit shell-shocked. I actually did nothing. I literally just kept her warm. I kept her hide box really moist for a week or so. I palpated a little bit. I knew not to get aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't take her to a vet. I didn't get oxytocin. I didn't do any of that stuff because I know that ultimately that does not work. And I don't mean to be anti-vet, but there's nothing, I personally believe there's nothing a vet can do to help save an egg-bound snake. If you cannot do it yourself at home, I don't believe anything a vet can do that's going to ultimately save that snake for breeding. Now, whether you want to make that decision to go in and operate and have a sterile snake for the rest of its life as a pet, that is a decision everyone makes to themselves. And there's no guarantee they'll survive that from the vet either.
Right.
Right.
So I left it alone. I left it for a week. Nothing had changed. She was basking a lot. She was kind of twitching like she was thinking she was incubating eggs, but obviously they're inside her. But there was no gross fluid coming out of the cloaca. There was no rot. There's nothing nasty. And again, every, you know, 4 or 5 days, I would kind of palpate the first egg to come out and see what I could do, and nothing would work. So then after about, I guess, 10 days, I aspirated the first egg, and that went pretty well, actually. I was surprised how easy that went. Now, again, this animal could still die a month from now, and I'll probably have a little bit of egg on my face, no pun intended, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, what are you going to do? But anyway, so aspirated the first egg and did nothing, and then just put her back and left her for another week, and she still, and I thought that would do it. I thought, okay, well, at least she can get the first egg out herself, but she couldn't. She still could not do it. So I guess the total now we're at like 2 weeks, maybe a little more, when she was due to post her due lay date, that I actually got all my gear ready to aspirate the rest of the eggs. So the first thing I did is I just said, forget it, I'm just going to palpate this out myself. And I normally never do this, but I went a little, you know, crazy, and I just pushed. And I know if I see the membrane before I see the egg, like if I can see the egg coming out the cloaca, but I can see membrane over it all, then I know then there's oviduct, and that I have to stop and have to go back in and try and manipulate it around. But I kept doing it, and sure enough, I saw egg with no membrane around it, so I kept pushing, and I got that egg out.
Cool.
And I was just like, holy shit, there's no prolapsed oviduct. There's nothing. This came right out. So then I went to do the second egg. No, it was stuck as well and wouldn't budge. So I aspirated it, got it out. I was like, holy wicked, I got the second egg out. And I didn't know how many were in there for sure. And the next several eggs, the next two eggs came out without aspiration, without me aspirating them.
Huh.
Wow.
I know. I did it, obviously. I palpated them out, but I was able to do it again. There's no oviduct coming out. As soon as the egg got at the cloaca, there was pure egg. Came out, no problem. And then I was left with the last egg, the fifth one, and I had to aspirate and get that one out as well. But I did it, and again, it was no problem. That last egg was a little tricky. It did actually want to come out with the oviduct. The membrane was over it, so I had to push it back in and kind of maneuver it around in there. That's the most important thing, and I don't really recommend people palpate eggs out unless they really, really know what they're doing. But if you do it and you see that membrane over the egg, you have to stop pushing right away because you cannot tear or rip that oviduct. I know other people say differently. They've flashed open the oviduct, pushed the egg out, and have it heal. But I've had bad experiences with that.
Right.
So, yeah, got that egg out and got her out. So, sorry to go on a crazy tale, but...
That's cool. No, that's good.
So hopefully next year. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to feed the living crap out of that thing.
There you go.
I'm going to power feed, pump feed, testosterone, whatever things, chemicals. I'm going to make that thing so big, you're not going to know what hit it.
Cool.
So, yeah, I'm going to turn that thing into a giant jumbo rat-eating monster, and then I'll see what happens. You know,
and now
sometimes
the eggs that did come out are good, right?
No. The people I've spoken to and the literature I've read, those eggs have – that's one – like, I think reptile eggs are really hardy, I agree. I mean, I've abused my temperature extreme. I just think they're super hardy generally. I mean, sometimes embryos are non-viable and they grow – you know, 30 days later they die, but I don't think it's anything we do unless it's ridiculously – you know, like way too wet or way too dry. I mean, just ridiculous. But – if eggs are not laid, and I don't know what the finite time is, I'll just say a day or two, but it could even be less. But when those eggs are due to be laid and they are not laid and you get them out later, they're toast. There's nothing to do. And I did put the two eggs I palpated out, I did throw in the incubator just for a joke. Because they look like a freshly laid egg, and they didn't smell of rot or anything, even though they're 2 weeks. But they died pretty, you know, they were dead. They went bad pretty quick. But, yeah, it'd be interesting to see if anybody out there has ever palpated an egg out from a female that's several days past a due date when they know for sure she was supposed to lay, and they got an egg to be viable. But I think the babies die. I think the reason a female lays is there's a chemical reaction with her and the eggs and what the babies need, maybe. I don't know. I'm not a scientist here, but I think there's something going on there.
Right.
So,
yeah, it's funny that you have that same experience at Owen. You had that same type of thing happen this year. Well, not you didn't have to palpate the eggs, but you had the problem.
Pretty close to it.
Yeah. Terry he had the problem with the one of his inlands. You know, I don't know. It's kind of weird that there was somebody else was saying the same thing that they had that happen.
Chris Bioff had some problems too. He and I were talking back and forth online about him taking his, because my caramel female was, I think, bound up with her eggs, and we ended up giving her oxytocin, and she laid all 22 day after we gave her oxytocin, and she gave them out perfectly, and then she laid her eggs 42 days after her prelay shed was when we finally got them out, and they just hatched 3 days ago, and I got all the babies. So
that's awesome.
Yeah,
that's incredible. And so she was for sure egg bound. Like when she was due to lay, she was having problems.
When she was due to lay, she kept basking belly up, and she would do it all day every day, and she wouldn't really.
Yeah.
She wasn't really like she was kind of twitching a little bit, but nothing like. I think she was crying.
Yeah.
She kept digging around. I put mulch in her cage, which I don't normally do, and she made this huge divot, and she kept moving stuff, kept throwing, like, you know, paper was going into the water dish. She was curling up there, moving around. She just was not comfortable. So.
Yeah, no. I know exactly what you're talking about. Mine, I could actually see the contractions. Like, I could actually see her contract. Like, she was trying. And she did have the first egg right at the cloaca, but she just could not get it the last couple inches. It just wouldn't budge for her. So, but that's awesome. But getting back to what you said, I've spoken to a few guys in the U.S., and I've been hearing that, I don't know if this is true, I don't know if you guys have heard this, but it's been kind of a funny year for people with carpets.
Oh, dear God.
Yeah.
Dude, everyone's having problems.
Am I on to, no, am I saying something that's true, or am I sounding like I'm crazy?
No, you're right on. From what I've been talking about, there have been... I don't think we've had this many problems. Like almost every carpet breeder that I know had one issue or another this year. It was just a weird, weird year for everybody, except for Eric. So
hey, that's great.
That's because I went
everyone
to an incubation.
That's not a weird thing. That's you not checking your equipment before you started playing around with your snakes. Anyway, I digress.
it's not a big deal here, but I had a had a jungle clutch, and it was a new male. I got this really cool little German bloodline male jungle. There's not, don't know this, you probably don't care, it doesn't matter, but there's no real nice jungles up here in Canada. I mean, there's definitely a few, but nobody's really going to bother pulling CITES to send a jungle up to Canada. It's just, they're not worth the value, it's just not worth the hassle, right? So
right.
Anything nice jungle-wise when carpets were huge up here, you know, years ago, you know, I mean just sort of the mainstream carpets, you know, they're, most of those are all long gone, right? So there isn't really a lot of nice jungles up here. So I got this really cool little male German bloodline jungle, and he's tiny, man. Like, he's, like, probably come up to 4 years this summer, and he's tiny. He's like a corn snake. He's so cool. And I bred him to one of my not that old, you know, probably 5-6-year-old proven breeder female jungle. So just basic jungle to jungle, something I've done walking in my sleep for years. And I got, like, 20 slugs and one fertile egg.
Yeah.
And I was really surprised. I mean, now it is the first year I've ever used this guy, and I never saw them breed. You know, carpet pythons, if they're breeding, you see them breed. I mean, they're crazy.
Right.
So I wasn't really brutally surprised, because maybe this guy's just going to take longer to mature. Maybe he's just a crappy breeder, you know. But, yeah, so I have to say that I've, you know, it's pretty rare to have. I mean, I've had lots of slugs or clutches that weren't what I thought they were going to be, but have all slugs in one, yeah, it's not normal, you know.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That is weird.
I don't know if it's something to do with what was going on with some people this year, or just he was a young male. I don't know, but kind of surprised me, to say the least.
Yeah, I went to breed last year, 2010, and I think my males were too small. I saw a lot of lockups, but I didn't get anything. And then this year, I bred the zebra jag to two different females, and the first clutch was good, and then the second clutch was I had three eggs that were bad. Two of them were zebra jags, and one of them was a zebra, which hurt.
I forgot about that issue.
Yeah.
This year.
But one of the cool things about the maternal incubation was there was a moldy egg in the clutch, right? And the rest of the clutch was fine. Now, I don't know. I haven't incubated eggs yet, but I've heard that when you incubate them and you got a moldy egg in there, that they kind of go bad quick.
They do.
Yeah. Which I thought was kind of weird. I don't know what the female is doing different. That
I think it would have been probably airflow and humidity. There's no way how do I say this? What we do with artificial incubation that does work is not necessarily what a female python would do when she incubates her eggs maternally.
Yeah.
Just because it works for us doesn't mean that's what's happening. Not even in the wild, even in captivity, doesn't mean that's happening with that female and those eggs. So I think there's a big difference in airflow and humidity, and that probably plays a huge role in having a egg go bad and start to mold up and die in a maternally incubated clutch as opposed to an artificial. And it's probably because, I'm just guessing here, but maternal, because of those differences, the egg probably dries out quicker more or has a more natural, better way of drying out. And when you do it artificially, it can't do that. There's just so much humidity, that makes a bit of a difference, and that's why it can spread. Because if I have a moldy egg, I usually try and get it, cut it out if I can. You know what I mean? Like, cut it out of the clutch
right.
If I'm able to.
Mm-hmm.
It's not worth the risk, number one. I don't want to risk it. And, yeah, and it, for sure, if it took your whole clutch down. I think some species are more susceptible. Like, chondros is a big one, where even when they do it maternally, some people have had problems.
That,
I have not experienced that because I have not done maternal incubation. I've had a friend of mine who breeds chondros, and he and I do some chondro stuff to get a little bit of chondro stuff together. He's done maternal, and I think he had a few, but I think they just dried up at the bottom, no big deal. But I know I've read a lot of information about people having, you know, non-viable chondro eggs maternally incubated and take the whole clutch down. But again, is that because we keep them too wet than what they really need? You know, there's all these parameters that, you know, we probably don't fully understand.
Sure. Yeah. What about, you know, just on a side note, we're talking about the different morphs a while back and stuff. What do you think of the carpet python market?
I don't buy any. No, I think it's awesome, actually. I mean, I guess the first thing you have to do is you know, if you take a magnifying glass and look at the carpets and prices and stuff, you know, and just look at that one little bit, you could maybe, you know, complain and cry about prices and all and demand and stuff. But I think if you look at the whole our whole reptile market as a whole, and I mean from leopard geckos to other lizards to ball pythons to boas to retics to everything and carpet pythons, I think carpet pythons have done amazing. I mean, there's new morphs, there's more interest, more people want to get into them. I just think it's incredible. I mean, I really, and I'm not just saying that because I have carpet pythons. It's true. I mean, so like the boa market has been hit pretty hard.
Right.
I think it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. I think the retic market, I mean, maybe this isn't true in the U.S., okay, because I'm sort of thinking of other parts of the world, but like up in Canada, most of Canada, you cannot legally keep a retic or a berm or any large constrictor. You're just not allowed. It's illegal. So, yeah, I think basically, if you're into boas and pythons, and you're not into a ball python, and you're not into a boa, which a lot of people aren't into boas. A lot of people love boas, and I do too, but a lot of people, you know, they like a python. I mean, what else is there? You can't keep a retic. You can't keep a berm. What's a cool python that crawls around? I mean, bloods, they're kind of like a ball. They kind of sit around and hide all day, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. It just comes down to carpet pythons. And they also make cool pets for displaying. I mean, let's be honest. There's nothing. I don't care if it's a... If it's not a very pretty coastal, or even if it's kind of a muddy jungle, I just get a kick out of seeing them up on a perch. I think it's cool. I think it's a cool thing to see is a carpet on a perch.
Yeah, I would agree. That's cool. I often like to talk to ball python guys because when they breed, one of the things that I always point out is that they have like these dinker projects going on, and they look at these. We talked about this last week with Brian Barchak that, you know, they have these little ball pythons that if me and Owen were to look at them, would probably say, oh, that's just a normal ball python.
Normal ball python, yeah.
But, you know, there's like this little marker or whatever, and you know, it turns into this crazy morph. And, you know, carpets being so, you know, diverse just within a clutch with their looks and stuff, I think sometimes we overlook it. Do you see any, you know, do you have any dinker ball python projects, or do you have anything that's along those lines?
I don't really have any dinker stuff. I definitely agree with you that definitely it's worth paying attention to. I think one of the differences, well, okay, number one, look at the caramel carpet python. Mm-hmm. If you go back in time far enough, I mean, I realize people thought, but no, you know, you go back far enough, we didn't even realize what a caramel was.
Right.
I mean, I know they look different now, and I know there's a super, but it's very comparable to some of the ugly ball pythons, like yellow. I mean, I don't mean to say, you know, yellow belly ball pythons are ugly, but they're not that great, right?
Right. Right.
And neither, I'm going to be honest here, neither is a caramel by themselves. I mean, yes, there are certain examples of caramels that are gorgeous, but generally speaking, they're not, like, super beautiful. But look at the cool, I mean, we're just beginning to make cool stuff. So you are 100% right, definitely. I think a caramel is a great example because if we didn't really know what a caramel was and what it makes, and you know had a bunch of varying looking coastals and had some caramels in there, especially some uglier caramels, you probably wouldn't even know it's a caramel. I know people that hatch out caramel clutches don't know if it's a caramel for sure.
Right.
That's how kind of, you know. So, but I think the big difference with say the ball pythons is there's so much more wild caught stuff coming in all the time. I mean, I know with ball pythons is not what it used to, but because you're seeing so many wild caught, you're seeing more chances for those unknown markers.
Right.
And I know there's lots of carpet pythons being bred, but there's not a lot of wild blood. Like, it's not like we're getting animals from Australia. I'm surprised we don't see more weird stuff out of Indo. It just blows me away. I don't know what's going on there. Like, why, with all the carpets imported out of Indo, we never saw more weird morphs. So I do agree. I just think we don't have access to animals to possibly have those genes. I don't know. Does that kind of make sense? That with ball pythons,
yeah,
so much
yeah,
wild-caught
sure.
stuff, you have access to that. With the carpets, I don't think we do. Hey, maybe I'm going to eat my word, and next year someone will breed some coastals together or some jungles and hatch something out crazy. But, I mean, you know, where did the – you know, the interesting thing is I don't even know where the zebra came from. I suppose it just serendipitously occurred for Paul. I can't remember if he bought it somewhere off someone or if he just made it out of nowhere. I don't know where the jags come from. I know it started with Jan Erik, but we don't really know where he got it from. Did it, again, happen to exist in a clutch, or did he get it somewhere? We don't really know. I mean – You know, the caramels, as far as I know, in Europe started in France. I don't know how where those came from.
Right.
So maybe there's more to this, and I'm just ignorant and don't know where some of this stuff came from and how it was created, and we'll never know because it's a secret. I don't know.
Yeah. I guess when I go and I look at different, kind of have what some people would consider dinker carpet projects. Like I have a couple, I don't even know what they are. They were sold to me as Atherton carpets, but they look Exanic.
African carpet pythons.
Well, they came from Derek Roddy, and they were sold to him as Atherton jungles, right? But
yeah, like African people and the locality in Australia is what you're talking, right?
Yeah, exactly. But
yeah.
I'm not going to say
African.
That they're.
I'm like,
no,
oh,
I'm
no, yeah. You said Atherton is in Australia.
Like, dude, you got head.
Anyway. You would swear they're Exanic. I don't know. I know.
So do you own these animals now?
Yeah. Yep.
So are you going to breed them together?
Yep. And I have Exanic stuff too. Like, and I'm going to try to breed them together and see if it's compatible or see what happens.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm just curious to see like things like that. You know, I mean, you know.
Oh, wait, and I agree. There are a few things like that out there, and it's definitely worth hanging on to them. I guess what kind of makes it, I hate to repeat myself on this one, but again, I'm up in Canada, so if I was to cruise through Kingsnake and see some crazy looking carpets, I don't have access to them.
Right.
It's not going to be worth anyone's time. It is very frustrating. Right. You guys don't know how lucky you are in the U.S. in some regards to have that. It's, you know, it's just, there's no one who's going to pull sighties on, you know, a couple $300 dinker carpets, because just to ship it just for the permit and the brokers and every, it's $1,000 basically, $500 to $1,000. Just forget the animal.
It's gonna be worth it.
It's gonna be $500 to $1,000 out of your pocket just to have a box sent over the border up to an airport up here for you to go clear it. And you still have expenses on your end. So, and you know, and then how do you get the sighties? It's the pain in the butt. And then you know you have to rely on someone to do it as a favor. And is it worth, you know, gonna hassle people for? It's just But if you have the opportunity to buy something you think is cool, it's definitely worth it. Again, for me, doing this for a living, when I have a lot of animals already, it's sometimes I've had a chance with certain things, more ball python side, and I've just said, I don't even want to try. It's just not worth my time.
Right.
It's a big risk. I mean, it could pay off huge if it does, but if it doesn't, and all the time to sort of keep the project and you know, properly do it, it's a big thing.
Yeah, that's true.
You know. So, but hey, if you got space, you got time, and you really believe it, oh, it's worth it. I mean, can you imagine if those worked out? If those did prove to be a new line of Exanthic jungle or something, that would be amazing.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, I would
it's
be excited.
It's stuff we
that's
dream
for
of.
Sure.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
That's the thing we dream of. You know.
Do you with dealing with ball pythons and carpets? Do you see a lot of people that are branching over from ball pythons to carpets? Do they show an interest or?
A bit of both. I haven't really noticed someone that's hardcore into ball pythons with a huge collection and then bang, want to get into carpets. They may have a couple, but what I have noticed, and I see this a lot, well, I don't want to say a lot, but quite a bit, is let's say I have a customer that maybe is getting into reptiles or maybe more getting back into reptiles. It's amazing the people who leave this hobby and then come back in later. It blows my mind every day. It's just insane. And I've noticed that some people who, you know, used to keep stuff 5-10 years ago, doesn't matter what it was, maybe it was ball pythons, but they come back in and they get a bit of everything because, you know, they want back in, right? And
right.
You know, they think they want just ball pythons, but maybe they get a few pairs of bloods and they get some carpets and other stuff. And I have noticed that a lot of people who buy ball pythons, when they're buying other animals, quickly get bored of their ball pythons and say, I don't want ball pythons. I want to do all blood pythons. I want to do all carpets. I'm going to do boas. Definitely. I have noticed that for sure.
Okay.
And it can kind of go the other way, but usually it's people who get a little bit of everything and think they really want to do balls because, you know, all the different combinations. But some people don't really like, you know, the whole sterile rack
brick in a tub.
Ball pythons.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, let's be honest, you don't have to keep ball pythons that way. I mean, there's no reason why you can't keep them in a 4-foot cage, right? A female,
right.
Anyway.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they probably will do better in the tub, you know, they feel more secure and feed and breed better. But,
I
know a lot of people, they just get frustrated with their balls. Someone emailed me a couple of weeks ago, and he says, I don't care if I lose money, and I'm going to get rid of my balls, and I hate snakes that don't eat and just sit there in a tub. This is wasting my time. I want snakes I can see eat, and they're exciting, and I walk into my room, and there they are. They're not all in this
perched
bloody
up and
rubbermaid tub. It's like I could have sewing material in those tubs and a sewing machine in the corner. No one would even know there's snakes in here, you know?
I often wonder for, like, the you know, for somebody that does it full time, like, is it worth having a couple of ball python projects to sort of get somebody in and then show them how cool carpets can be, you know? It's like...
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I always preach variety to people. And maybe it's bad advice, but I personally think it's good. I think that people have a little bit of everything. I really think it's important. Because so many people will, I don't know, hatch out their first clutch of one thing, and then, you know, maybe it doesn't sell that well, or the results weren't what they expected, but if it's all one thing, if they get a variety, then it seems to keep their interest a little better, or let them decide what they like, not have everyone else tell them the ball pythons is the only thing worth keeping.
Right.
You know? And certain markets are hard to sell, are easier or harder to sell certain animals, you know? Like, just some areas, animals don't, you know, ball pythons, everybody has them, you know? Producing bumblebees isn't really the ultimate answer. You're going to be competing with everybody out there, you know? It's like you go to reptile shows. I mean, I don't really go to reptile shows, but I talk to all my friends that do and see all the photos on the net, and it's just, it really is just a ball python world, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's kind of nice to have something different to stand out, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of like, I did have ball pythons when I got back into this reptiles, and
you had reptiles, and then you got out, and then you came back in again, kind of thing.
Yep.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, I was a musician, and I was traveling a lot and whatnot, and I just really didn't have time, so I kind of got out of it. And then one day I just decided that I wanted to get a snake again, and I actually got back into berms, and then, you know, I got out of that because they were just, it was just too much, you know.
Yeah.
And
one big berm bowel movement, and that's enough.
Yeah.
Or urination.
Yeah, which I still love berms, but it's just, you know, I just couldn't keep what I wanted to keep, and, you know, space issues and whatnot. And I moved on to just wanting pythons, and I got some, you know, your pastel, the normal type of ball pythons. But, and I wanted to kind of do both, and the carpets just were much cooler to me, and I just sold all my ball pythons, you know.
And you're not alone. I know. And, you know, let's be honest. It can go the opposite way. You know, you get a few balls, a few carpets, a few boas, and before you know it, you're all boas, or you're all ball pythons. You know what I mean? But
sure, absolutely.
I have noticed when people have a variety, they definitely love the carpets, you know. I think some people, though, I think the only thing that really makes people want to do ball pythons more is kind of the sort of more bitiness, you know, the little bit slightly more aggression that a carpet python has.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a ball python generally is really easy to handle. And I think there's a certain, I don't know, group or subgroup of reptile people that really like an animal that generally doesn't bite, just kind of sits there like a lump.
Right.
You know? And then there's other people that love
them.
Who are those people? Yeah, I know. Well, I know, they're not true reptile keepers. No, I know. And then there's a lot of people that, you know, that's what they love about carpet pythons. They have that edge to them, you know. You know they're alive and you're alive. They do something. They bite you.
Yeah.
That's why I moved up into scrubs, you know. It's like they mellow to me, and it was like, okay, well, I'm going to get into scrubs, and now we're talking.
Yeah.
And okay, do you still have scrubs now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I got some Barnex, Tannen Bars, Malukins,
cool.
Halma Harris. Yeah, I got the...
Yeah.
Oh, Halma Harris.
Yeah, one.
Yeah. They're beautiful. Yeah, they're beautiful. They're awesome snakes. There used to be a couple people here in BC that were breeding them, and they made some pretty cool babies. They're pretty neat snakes.
Yeah. Eric here set up that colony in Halmara.
Yeah, eventually. I hope to. Yeah. So. I don't know. Cool snakes.
Yep. I love my Malukans. I love my Malukans and my white lips. So.
Yeah, how white lips are another beautiful snake. Yeah, they're awesome.
I love my white lips.
How big? What's the biggest scrubs you guys have?
How big are your scrubs, Eric?
I think my Marooks, I have Marooks. They're probably the biggest. I would say probably about 5-6 foot.
Okay.
So they're
still on
the small side.
Yeah.
I think my Malukans, my four adult Malukans, they're about 6 foot each. So. And they got a nice strike range. So.
Yeah, I know. They're pretty amazing. And I think white lips are incredible too. Do you have the is it the black ones or the gold phase or?
I have 1.2 of a trio of the gold phase.
Yeah.
And then I have 1.1 of the black phase.
You do have the black phase. That's cool. I've never owned those or seen them in real life, and I know they're beautiful.
I had the worst experience today. We were expecting a import female black phase today. And she arrived the OA. She was an adult female, and this is the first black phase that we've seen in the country in 18 months. And, God, we're all devastated here. It's like, oh, no.
Oh, dude, so I'm so sorry.
It's take a long time to try to track down another one. So, but hopefully next year I'll be producing. Oh, it's disgusting. I'm at work and I was almost sick to my stomach when my buddy texted me going, oh, DOA. I'm like, no. So,
man, that's hard. Do you have any idea what happened?
Yes.
Who
no
knows?
Heat pack. And
what was that story?
No heat pack, and it got pretty cold here today. So.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
I hate stuff like that. It's
me too.
I think that's the sort of the scary part about this is shipping reptiles is it can be a pretty nerve wracking time.
I'm always nervous when I send something, and I've been on the phone screaming at FedEx several times to where they almost sent an animal back from Arizona because they said, "Oh, we can't put it on a truck because they were unsure of if they could transport it." So I had to literally yell at them for about 20 minutes to get them to put it on the truck and drive it up the street to where it had to go. So
yeah, no, I agree. Shipping, I hate dealing with stuff like that. And I know shipping reptiles, I mean, I do a lot of international shipping, and that just, oh, my God. Sometimes it takes 48 hours for a shipment to make where it has to go or longer, and it's just like.
Oh, God.
Kind of, yeah.
Man, that has to be stressful.
Oh, yeah, it's probably the worst part. For me, it's probably the worst part about this is the shipping. And I'm always responsible for everything, too, right?
Yes. Yeah.
You know, like, pretty much as someone, you have to guarantee live arrival.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You have to. Yeah. So, and you got to take care of it if stuff goes wrong. And you got to make sure that, you know, you also got to cover yourself. Like, I have alerts that it'll text my phone to when the package has arrived. And then, like, the customer calls me 3 hours later, go, hey, I just opened the box and something's wrong. I'd be like, hey, what were you doing for 3 hours? Where was the box? So hopefully that has not yet happened, but, you know, it's knock on wood that it never has to.
Yes. Well, you know, I think, like, we, you know, sort of common sense will help, you know. I think the more...
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, looking at weather and where it's going, where it's coming from, just common sense stuff can usually save a lot of problem. I think it's people who just do crazy things last minute. But, you know, at the end of the day, shit's going to happen, good and bad. There's no way you can avoid it all the time.
That is true. Now, Don, how do you keep your carpets up in Canada?
well, you know, it's pretty basic. I mean, all my adults are in 4 foot cages, you know, and then 4x2 is a base dimension, and then the height will depend on how big it is or what sex it is. Most of my males are in like a foot tall, and females are 16 inches to 2 feet tall. Awesome. I use a light source for my heat, just a bulb, just
okay.
a spot bulb,
okay.
usually 50 to 30 watts, depending on time of year and sort of ambient temperatures in the room and where the cage sits. Obviously, bottom cages are going to be a lot cooler than cages higher up, and a taller cage will need a higher wattage bulb than a shorter cage. Over the last couple of years, I've switched to pine wood chips for a bedding.
Okay.
And absolutely love it. It absorbs urine really well and dries out feces, and you know, it's so easy. If you can see when anything they've done, whether it's a little bit of urate or anything, it's easy to spot clean. I usually have hide box. Sometimes I have perches, sometimes I don't. It really depends on the animals. I've noticed the albinos tend to be quite arboreal. A lot of the carpets are not as. Here I am going on how great it is to see them on a perch, but generally when they get big, they're not that. I think you guys would agree that most carpet pythons as adults, are not, especially females, are not that arboreal.
Yeah, I'll agree with that.
Now maybe if you put her in a huge cage, you might see it. So maybe it's partly the way we keep them. But so I tend to do just a hide box, water dish. And, mm-hmm. Depending on the species of the animal, they may get a perch, they may not. And that's pretty much it. You know, all my cages are sliding glass doors. Minimal ventilation, not tons, not too little, not too much. I don't miss them ever. I more try and keep the ambient humidity, depending on time of year and stuff. I try and keep it around 50, 60, but sometimes that can be tough. I sometimes will sort of pour water on the pine bedding if they're in a shed sometimes, just depending on if I think maybe they need it. That's pretty much it, you know. The spot bulbs, it just depends on the time of the year, but generally if they want to be 90, 91, 92, 95 under the spot bulbs, they have no problem doing it. I notice a lot of time they will lay just off to the side of the spot bulb, not directly under it.
Mm-hmm.
My ambient temperatures in the cage are going to be a little bit warmer than the room temperature, but ambient room temperature, again, I use these sort of outside temperatures, the seasons we have to sort of help create the breeding and the temperature changes.
Mm-hmm.
So, sort of spring, summer, the ambient room temperature is, anywhere from 76 to 81, and the evening temperature spring, summer probably goes down to, 75, 78, depending on how cold it is outside. And then in winter for cooling, I used to cool a lot more down to sort of high 60s, low 70s. But
mm-hmm.
last couple of years, I've been doing the ambient room temperature is down to 74 degrees, maybe 73 on a really cold day. And again, during the day, winter or summer, their bulbs are on and no heat at night. So the bulbs are on, from 6 or 7 in the morning till 5 or 7 at night. Just depends on the time of year and what's going on with temperatures.
Right.
If my room gets down to power goes out or something crazy happens and the room goes down to 68 at night, they have no heat to go to, and I've never had a problem. I've always had no heat at night, But,
okay.
I mean, yeah, I think that's the beauty of a lot of pythons is they're so adaptable to different temperatures we breed. There's a lot of different ways to get to the same result of breeding them.
Right.
Some people, I think, really stress out about temperatures. There probably is a key temperature for sperm production and follicular development, and it's probably, I don't know, maybe it's not that cold as we think. I'm not too sure, Maybe we don't have to have the temperatures go up and down as much. But I ideally wanted to try and keep them a little warmer and have successful clutches. And at 74 degrees as a nighttime cold, I've had so far, it's been pretty good. Last year was great. I had, almost perfect fertility. And this year, it's not been too bad. I mean, that jungle clutch was a disaster. But, again, I think that was because he was a young male.
Right. From what I've heard, there are a lot of people now who are keeping their carpets strictly at 80 degrees across the board all year round, and they've had successful breeding and things like that with them. We had Terry Phillip on, and he was telling us he keeps everything. I mean, everything. If it's a rough scale python to, this random boa constrictor, 80 degrees flat, and claimed he never got RIs and everything was happy and breeding and go for it.
I've heard that too.
Sure about that. Mm-hmm.
I know, and I don't doubt them, and I just, and I believe it's probably, I sometimes wonder if it is a better way of doing it, you know, if it's less stressful to the animals. But I think I'm happier. That would be a big risk for me to do that. I just couldn't, because if it screwed up and didn't work for me, I'm sure it works great for other people, but if it didn't work for me in my situation, because this is my job, oh my God, I'd be screwed. I have no income.
Right.
I don't have much, unless I can sell blood to someone. But it kind of makes sense, because I think a lot of, it's kind of yes and no. A lot of times these people say I keep them in 80 degrees, and a lot of my snakes love to be at 80 degrees, like carpets in a cage, ball pythons in a rack. If you temp gun them, a lot of times they tend to maneuver around, so they're 80 degrees. But there's also times when I'll temp gun them and they're 90 degrees. And I don't know how to answer that, because in the wild, I've never been to Australia, I've never been to Indonesia, I've never seen these animals out in the wild. From the limited amount of reading I've done, it seems that they've temp gunned these temperate snakes outside, and they do reach high 80 degrees. And obviously they would have to do eggs. But even outside of breeding, they do bask, and we know that they get warm pretty quick. So I just like to give them that option.
His thing is, he didn't, I don't know if he really got into gravid females, because I think there was a paper.
I think he would move them or put them in a rack or a cage that is heated, so that once they're gravid, they can go gestate.
Then there was a paper that was done. I think it was on children's pythons that they actually, it was the snakes they used, but temperature that they all sought out was 84 degrees, and that's where they kept. That's what they sought out to keep the eggs good. I think what he was saying is he goes for the core body temperature. And what he said, this is how I try to explain it, is that a snake tries to adjust, you know, to 82 degrees body core temperature. So if it's too cold, it moves into a heat spot so that it can bring its temperature up to 82 degrees. It doesn't want to be 90 degrees. It may go to a 90 degree hot spot in order to get to 82 degrees. Or it may move out of the heat. To a cooler spot so that it's not quite as hot. And he was saying that's why you see snakes come out at nighttime and all that. And I don't know. That's how I kind of keep mine, and it seems to work for me. And
so, do you have a heat panel on yours instead of a bulb?
No, I just have the. When I did have gravid females, I did put heat on them. But other than that, I don't really. There is heat tape there, but the heat tape is set at 82 degrees, and my room is at 81 degrees, so it very rarely comes on. So they pretty much sit right at 80 degrees. And the only time... Oh, go ahead.
You have a heater to heat that room to 81 degrees then, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so you have an oil field heater or an air heater, or whatever you have some way of heating it with a thermostat, and that room's heated at 81 degrees, and that's 24/7 unless they're gravid, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. No, I know ball python people have done this too, and it's intrigued me, and it's just one of those situations where it's like something new. You want to try it because it's new, and it sounds amazing. Like, you know, maybe it's way stressful in the way to do it, and it would probably it's worth a try. Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it kind of just made I heard him talk about this a long time ago on Reptile Radio.
I did too, because he was talking about chondros when he said that, and I know, and I was thinking the same thing too. It's like, man, this makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and it's funny that, I don't know, it really, you know, because chondros were kind of like, oh, no, you know, they're so hard to keep, and, you know, they are constantly getting sick and all these things, and what he said just kind of made sense, and I just tried it with carpets, and, you know, it worked, so. I'm going to keep going with it. That's how I keep my chondros, too. I have two chondros, and I don't have any heat on them at all. None. They don't even have heat tape, actually.
Yeah, no, chondros generally, I've noticed they do prefer it cooler to begin with. I think sort of the keeping them in the high, you know, they prefer the 80 degrees to low 80s. I mean, anytime you see a chondro, unless it's in a very cold cage, it's in a very cold room, they're always on the cold end, always. So when he was talking about that, it definitely made a lot of sense. You know, that something's going on. The chondros specifically, you know, they love. But, you know, chondros, that's a whole other ball game. They're definitely, they can be a tricky species. They're not so, I don't know, have you guys bred them yet?
No, I have not. No.
I have not. I
hear about the nightmares, though.
I hear the nightmare stories. I was thinking about this today. I don't want to sound like a smartass. I find that they're not that hard to breed. Now, I'm no chondro expert, and I've actually been sort of slowly shrinking my chondro collection just because there's only so much time and space to do so much. I still have quite a few. And I've had mixed results. I'm not the most accomplished chondro breeder. That's definitely for sure. But they're not. I don't think they're the hardest species to breed. What I've had trouble with is sort of keeping them healthy over a 10-year span. Like an animal, you know, at 10 years of age, still be able to breed and be a healthy, perfect animal. Mm-hmm. I've just had trouble with longevity of them. And you know, maybe it's something. You know, maybe the sort of traditional way of keeping chondros is maybe he's right. It's not the right way. But as far as breeding, hatching eggs, usually not a problem. The babies, getting them started is. My technique is I just force feed them till they eat.
Okay.
My technique. I wait 2-3 weeks to try and tease feed them, and then after that I just say fuck it. I just force feed them till they eat. It's for me it's easier.
Right.
It's just because it just drives me nuts to sit and I've had amazing success doing that. I mean, I guess I have small nimble hands and I'm able to do it. You know, I have a really good technique down where I can just wail through 10 or 12. Well, it's not 20, but you know, 10 or 15, no problem. But as far as the assist or the tease feeding, you know, get two to eat and 2 days later try again, two more eat, and oh my god, it's just like I can't do it. I just don't have the time or the patience. I'll go mental. So what I would do is once a week I would force feed them, and I have a great little technique, a beautiful little pair of crappy old sort of rounded tweezers that, you know, I can get a meal down their throat without hurting them, and it works great. And it just, you know, within probably 2 months, every single one of those snakes is wailing down food on its own.
Awesome.
Oh,
but
wow.
Yeah.
Good.
But tease feeding them is a real, oh my God. That's an art, too.
Yeah. You know who has a really good video on that is Buddy Buscemi. He has a really good video on how to get them to go.
Yeah, I think I've heard about this. Is he the one that he's tried putting them on a little wire coil, like at a distance, and like the pinky, so there's the wire. Rather than tweezers, he uses a long, thin wire, and that kind of keeps you distance from the baby. Is that in there?
No, I didn't see that one. But that's a good idea, though. But he just sort of teaches it.
Yeah. There is an art. He's sort of tapping on the neck, the side of the head to try and get him to turn and bite and wrap it kind of thing.
Yeah, and he has a certain way that he does it, and, you know,
yeah.
Just like you said, if they, you know, he ends the session if they strike at it, and, you know, he had this one that he has a video, and it's about 10 minutes long or so, and, you know, it just keeps throwing the pinky. Bite it, throw it.
Yeah,
bite it,
yeah,
throw
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
bite
yeah,
it,
yeah,
throw
yeah.
it. And then finally he gets it to go.
Yeah, no, and I agree with him. If I've had that thing, I've sat down with like 4 or 5 of them, and you start at the first one, and you keep going through them until you get one to eat, and then you go back to the one that didn't, and again it doesn't eat, and you do the others, and then you know, and you're right. After 10 minutes, sometimes one will just magically eat, but sometimes when you're sitting at like 8 or 10 or 15, you know, or more chondros, you're just like, oh my god, I want to do something tonight,
one.
Or you've got. So many other animals to feed, you're just like, oh, this is not worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're frustrating. But I tell you what, there is not a more beautiful baby snake than a green tree python. End of discussion.
Oh, absolutely.
There's no way. I mean, they're a baby chondro has to be the most beautiful Morelia, I think, ever. It's just, they're incredible.
You know, the one thing I couldn't get over when I first got my first chondro, a baby chondro, was how small they are. They're so small.
Yeah.
So tiny.
They're so tiny. I know. And that's one thing that I don't breed a lot of chondros, but I don't sell them till they're a year or more older, sometimes 2 years. I mean, that's how few chondros I breed. Uh-huh. I'll just keep them in for a first year or two because it's not worth my time to send out such a tiny animal and have to deal with people having problems if they did.
Right.
Because you're right, they're so tiny. And even though they're eating and doing well, they still can be pretty sensitive the first little while, you know. And you know, I guess it's different. You know, the reptile market in the U.S. is a lot bigger, so you're probably dealing with a lot more people that probably know what they're doing with chondros.
Right.
But up here, there's lots of people that keep and breed chondros and know what they're doing, but sort of a lot of people who contact you interested in a chondro are probably not as proficient, you know what I mean, proficient at taking care of a snake, like such a delicate little snake.
Sure.
I mean, things like making sure it's shed the whole length of its microscopic thin tail. Because if there's a couple centimeters or you know, a quarter of an inch or something of skin that didn't come off, if you don't get rid of that, that's going to, boom, constrict the circulation, that little bit of tail will drop off.
Yep.
Dry up. You know, stuff like that, you just, you know, they're so delicate. Or having it strike off its perch and put so much pressure on its last couple inches of tail, you're going to kink it up, you know? Just stuff like that, so.
Yeah. I'll tell you the other cool thing about chondros was when I first saw it do the chondro, or the, what the hell is it called? The caudal luring. Yeah.
Yeah, isn't that incredible?
Yeah, that was really cool.
I think that is, I love that. I just, again, I'm not a big chondro guy, but they're so unique. That's why I always have chondros. I'm either, I've got some adults I'm breeding, or I've got a clutch of babies I'm raising up or something. Absolutely, they are so cool. And I love that. Every time I go in, I always check for that caudal luring at night. And it's amazing how they can, not only do they wiggle it, but they sort of do a figure eight pattern, but they sort of move it side to side as they do the figure eight. It's pretty cool. It's really neat.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Really cool.
Awesome. When he showed that video trying to get babies to eat, did he tap the tail to try and get them to turn and bite?
I heard pinching the tail works.
Yeah.
No,
do
I
a little
think
bit with the tweezers.
But I don't know if you can do that with a chondro. I wouldn't want to pinch a chondro because the tail is just too tiny. You'd probably screw it up. But I know some guys have tried tapping. They tap the tail to try and get it to turn and bite the pinky, because that's what the caudal luring is all about, right? Getting the prey item nearby.
Yeah, get it to nearby and then they bite it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'll have to go watch it again and pay more attention to that. I never thought of that. That's kind of makes sense to me. I never thought of that.
Kind of interesting.
Where else were we? Okay, so we talked some chondro. What kind of chondro projects are you working with? Do you just do locality stuff, or are you doing designer
stuff? No, it's all kind of crazy designer stuff. Again, it's nothing.
Oh, wow.
It's nothing as fun as what some of the amazing, crazy stuff that you see in the U.S. But actually, even up here, some guys have got some really cool stuff lately. But I did get a couple. I did get a couple sort of. I don't know. They're not really. They're just designer chondros. They sort of were Greg Maxwell, Trooper Walsh kind of stuff. I have the lineage somewhere. I don't really remember exactly what they were. They were from blue stuff and a little bit of mite and some high yellow thrown in it as well. So I got a couple different males that I happened to get my hands on up here. I bred them to some of my own stuff. And I also managed to get a couple farmed chondros a few years ago, some really sort of unique-looking mainland ones. I don't know for sure what locality, probably just mainland. So I took some of these, you know, I took some of these two males I got and bred them to a couple females I had here and the farmed one, and I made some really cool babies that I'm just sort of raising up. And I've sold a few here and there and kept some. And I have one right now that is kind of a bluey-green, and I'm pretty sure it's a female. She's developed a ton of mite phase just out of the blue. Just tons of mite phase coming in on her.
Oh, they're my favorite. That's awesome.
Yeah. Now, again, it's not the crazy solid black things that I see on all the forums out of the U.S. and stuff that make me just go crazy. But yeah, it's pretty cool. It's got a lot of black. I'm really excited to see what it's going to look like. It just seems that as time goes on, it gets more and more black. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. And then last year, I got another really cool clutch from the male I had. He was a blue, sort of a from one of the blue gene lineages, and I bred him to this mainland female, and I got I got seven good babies I'm raising up from last year, and six of the seven are came out maroon. And
whoa.
Not always, but usually the maroon ones, I don't want to say this always, but I've noticed that the maroon ones, if anything's going to go crazy, they tend to have more chance of developing mite phase or crazy blue or any of that stuff, you know, from my very limited amount of breeding. So anyway, these babies are smoking. Like, they all look really cool. I'm really excited about them. And that's the other reason why I don't sell them, is because with some of this designer stuff, it's not really genetic, I don't really believe, as opposed to sort of polymorphic, is in that if you have these nice animals, your chances of getting nice animals are increased. But
right.
It's not like dominant or simple recessive or anything like that. So when you hatch these babies, because babies, chondros, change colors into adults so dramatically, let alone being designer stuff, you know, from yellow to green or maroon to green, you have no idea what they're going to look like.
Right.
So if you sell them as babies, like, I'm going to be honest, there's a lot of, I mean, to hatch out baby chondros, get the viable eggs, get the babies feeding, and get them to a sellable size is a lot of work, especially with some neat designer stuff. And then if you sell them before you know what they're going to look like, they're not worth as near as much because you don't know what they're going to look like. You can't price them. So chances are you could just hand someone off an amazing chondro for a steal, and there's no way I could do that. I would just throw it away. There's no way. And that's why I just have a very small chondro collection. I just if I get a clutch, I keep the whole clutch back, and I just take my time and raise them up slowly. And then in 2-3 years, I'll sell them if I want or whatever I want to do with them, you know? So,
right.
Yeah, I'm excited to see how these guys look.
Cool. Very cool. Now, I know before the show we were having our little talk. We started talking about mites and
the bug. Not
I'm spraying Raid in the air as we speak. I'm just spraying Preventamite right now.
Oh God!
And you said you had a end all be all.
Well,
technique
now you're gonna be. Yeah, now that I'm on public internet radio, I'm going to have to recant that. No, but I do have a really good method that's worked really well for me, and I know a lot of people are skeptical. They don't really believe, but I suppose this method would not work perfect if you had tons of bedding, tons of decorations, and a mite-infested collection of snakes. I mean, then you're in major trouble. But
right.
What I do is I have – this is more of a rock-solid quarantine to get rid of mites. And my main product I use is Reptile Relief. It's a product made in the U.S. by a company, and it's a spray. It's kind of like a soapy base spray. It has a very strange smell to it, almost like – I don't know. It has a very weird smell to it.
Yeah.
Almost like men's cologne that's got cat urine in it or something. It's just really gross. It's really weird. And if you breathe it in, it actually makes you cough. It's, you know, as you're spraying. But I found a key to using it. And what I do is if I send some snakes out to a buddy that takes them to a show and then, you know, stuff doesn't, you know, whatever didn't sell or whatever, it gets sent back to me, or any new snake I get. And it doesn't matter if it comes from a neighbor. And even if I know their collection is mite-free, every snake that comes back into this house gets this treatment. And what I do is you don't have to demix down the Reptile Relief. It just comes in a mister or a jug. I buy big jugs and put it in a spray bottle. I put the snake in a rack system that's specific for, has no other snakes in it. It's specific in my little quote quarantine rack. And there's no substrate at all. It's just a bare Rubbermaid. No paper towel, no nothing. The snake goes directly into that, like the minute, even from out of the bag or container. It's not dragged around the house with, you know, bedding everywhere and snake bags thrown casually around. It's literally nothing is moved, and the snake itself is carefully placed in this Rubbermaid, and I spray liberally quite a bit of Reptile Relief on it, so the snake and the Rubbermaid is totally coated. Then I put this Rubbermaid in the rack, and then I pour, I don't know, for a 16-inch Rubbermaid container, I maybe pour half a cup of water or quarter cup of water, and that'll keep the humidity up in there, and it kind of makes a Reptile Relief bath, but it's more just like a soak. And what happens is the Reptile Relief mixes with the water, and as the snake crawls around, the soapy Reptile Relief literally gets into every pore of the snake. And it'll get into the eyes, the heat pits, it'll get all the scales, it'll get into the belly scutes. Because the snake, you know, when a snake goes into a new cage from being shipped, they totally cruise around, right? I mean, that's the first thing
yes.
the snake does when you put it in its new cage.
Right.
So if you spray it down with Reptile Relief, pour a little bit of extra water. And the reason I put the extra bit of water is because you don't want all the moisture in the Reptile Relief to evaporate. Because then the snake, it kind of like has a thick soapy goo dried onto it the next day. It doesn't really hurt it, but I don't think it's as effective as if it's more liquidy. And that
right.
Reptile Relief is super safe. I don't know exactly how safe it is, but I think if you look on the bottle, it's like FDA approved. I think you could even drink the stuff and you're not, you wouldn't get that sick. I mean, maybe, I don't know. It's not
right.
toxic.
You get bad, but you'd live.
Yeah, it's got some Environmental Protection Agency number or something on it. Like it's supposed to be a really safe product. And I've been doing this probably I'm gonna guess 6-7 years now, and I'm not gonna say the words I want to say because you know I'll get mites tomorrow. But it has been so good, and literally I've had snakes come in from people, and like people I totally trust, and sure enough the next day there's dead mites everywhere. So what I do is after I've sprayed them down, I check them. Usually the next day I'll spray them again. Then the second day, I'll take the tub to the sink, and I will examine that tub with a light and a magnifying glass, like literally like I'm looking for nuggets of gold. And I will scan that whole Rubbermaid like crazy, looking for any little speck of dust. Obviously, I start off with a bone, super clean Rubbermaid. Like that thing is spotless, the snake goes into. And if after 2 days you don't see a mite, you're probably pretty good. So then what I do on day two is I rinse the snake off under the sink, okay? I give it a good bath, a good rinse, and I rinse the Rubbermaid out. I put the snake back in the Rubbermaid, and I spray it one more time with a little bit of Reptile Relief and no water, and I put it back, and usually newspaper, and then I put it back in the rack, maybe a little water dish, and I leave it for another week or 4 or 5 days, and then I check it again. And if I don't see mites, there's no way there's mites on that thing. There's no way. Because the first time you apply Reptile Relief, if you do it this way, if you spray the snake down heavily, pour in a little bit of water, leave it for a day or two, check it thoroughly. If you do not see any mites, there's no way it has mites. Because if it has mites, they cannot live through Reptile Relief. They cannot live through it. And the one thing that I know that some – up here in Canada, it's a little bit harder to get a Preventamite. It's sort of a pest issue over the – you know, an international pest product. It's not so simple. So everyone up here uses Nix. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Nix. I don't know if it's the same thing in the USA, but it's a hair product for kids,
yeah.
for hair lice.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yep.
So you take Nix, you mix it with water. It's like 15 mils Nix to, I think, a liter of water. You make a big jug of it. You shake it in the spray bottle, and you spray the snake down. Now, it does
mm-hmm.
work, but there is some information out there that some bugs, like mites, can become immune to certain levels of pyrethrins.
Okay.
And I know for a fact that people have used Nix like crazy, and it does not kill all the mites. I don't know if it's just because so many they've been exposed to it, they're almost immune to it, or they shouldn't be able to, but, you know, those mites are crazy. Like, I wouldn't be surprised.
Huh.
The thing is I'm probably not totally accurate on here, but I believe the pyrethrins kill the mite. I'm not sure how they do it, but I think it is more of on a poison level. But I could be wrong. Whereas the Reptile Relief, it breaks down their shell, so they just dry out. They just ooze all their liquid out.
Oh, okay.
And I think that is sort of a fundamental difference in what makes something a product like Reptile Relief safer than some of the other products. Now, all those other products with pyrethrins, they work great. I would never. I mean, if you have big elaborate displays and you go into the Reptile Relief, there's no way it's going to work. You'd have to go to a more harder chemical. You know, or let's say you pull all your snakes out of a wooden rack and you put them in Rubbermaids with Reptile Relief in a separate rack, and then you hose that rack down with, God, Vapona strips or Preventamite or whatever you're going to use. You know, you'd have to definitely do that. But for
right.
new snakes coming in, I can't believe more people don't use Reptile Relief, unless I'm just lucky and I don't know what's going on, but I've just had amazing results.
Everybody has their own thing that works, and what I'm finding interesting about the Reptile Relief is just how safe it is. I mean, I treat with ivermectin, and that's about as safe as the Reptile Relief. But, you know, it's kind of funny because on the other side of it, there's Preventamite, where, you know, I'm pretty sure there's a part of the Preventamite can that says, you know, don't spray directly at any carbon-based life form that you
it,
want
absolutely,
to live.
Absolutely, it does.
So, yeah.
Exactly, it does. No, I agree with you 100%, you know, and...
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've had animals I've spent a lot of hard-earned money on, and, you know, you get it, and it's perfectly healthy, but, you know, does it have mites or not? And you're just like, oh, my God, I can't – I mean, I just couldn't – I know some people, I guess, they're you know, they can just go with another product, spray it around, but I'm just like, no, I'm going to go for what's safe and what works.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I mean, it kills mites so fast, and they literally dry up to a little flat turd. Like, they're literally flat as a pancake. They just – nothing left.
Bastards.
I know. Oh, horrible. I get
it is
thinking
the
about
scourge
it, you know?
Of reptile keeping, you know?
I know. I know. It's horrible.
But you definitely should. I think the key is, you know, as you bring up a good point, and most more people should do this if they don't, is the quarantine issue. You know, that's
You're
the one thing that I worry about when I go to a show. You know, it's like if I start to vend at shows, you know, I could be meticulous in what I do, but, you know, somebody could come up and they touch somebody else's stuff, and next thing you know, you have mites.
Yeah,
so
to be honest, I know. If you doubt the ability of a mite, you should read that mite chapter in the Barker's Ball Python book. There's some pretty good information on how far a mite will travel, how many eggs it can lay, blah, blah, you know, what it can go through. A female can go, it's amazing. It's scary, you know. So I'm with you, you know. But, I mean, yeah, you know, any of those places can be a vector for them. I know. They're just, I know, it's crazy. And it doesn't have to be some high-tech, you know, quarantine system, just a rack off to the side outside of a main reptile room, just off to somewhere,
mm-hmm.
in, you know, somewhere around that's not right beside animals, that, you know, you can, you know, even if you've sprayed Preventamite on the floor and up and down the top and side of the rack, so at least if they crawled anywhere, they'd have to go through it and die before they get anywhere, you know?
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I never thought it would be a problem, but I purchased a pair of Brooks king snakes at a snake show once, and brought them back to the table and opened up the bag, and we hadn't seen the Brooks king snakes. We were picking them up at the show. Open up the bag, and they were crawling. And
I'm getting itchy already. I'm scratching.
I know.
Thinking about
here's the thing. Like, you know, I did this, and I opened the bag, and my friend Chris was there, and I gave them to him, and he ran like he had a bomb. Like, he's like, get him away from the table. He's running. And, like, he and I were freaking out, and it was everything got, you know, ivermectin was everywhere when we got home. Oh, my God, it was crazy. So, but, yes, definitely, I'm enjoying this conversation. So let's move on. Don, we have a bunch of questions that we ask people that are on our show that is just to get you probably hating us.
No problem. Fire away. I love questions like that.
Yeah, they're great ones. And the first one is, if you could have any carpet python in your collection, what would it be? Now, money is no object, and laws are nothing.
Are we talking existing morph or morph yet to be made?
Whatever.
Well, I guess it's a tough one. I tell you one thing is this is probably not a very commercially viable request, but I would love an amazing, amazing, amazing example of a hypobred lie, like those crazy Australian ones.
Yes.
And I don't mean sort of the ones that have been hatched outside Australia that are pretty cool looking. I mean, like, the most orangiest, craziest fire red ones that, like, you know, you look at and you're just like, oh my God. I still think that's one of the prettiest carpet pythons.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
And I know they're not. I don't know for sure, but from some of the guys in Australia I emailed, this is a long time ago. I don't believe they're genetically, like, it's a true genetic trait. It's sort of, I think it's polymorphic again. Whereas if you have them, you have more chances of having them. But it's not a. I could be wrong. Maybe they just. But that's what I got an email years ago from one of the breeders in Australia. I emailed him asking the genetics of those, and that's what he told me. It was just sort of a linebred trait. But I just can't believe how beautiful they are. And then with morphs, there are so many. I think a Sunglow zebra would be pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yes.
maybe a Sunglow zebra jag might be really cool. The other thing that would be neat is I've seen an exanthic jag in real life, and those are pretty incredible. I know it's probably not the craziest carpet morph, but to see one in real life, like a nice one, they're beautiful. And I think an exanthic zebra drag would be really nice. And also an albino super glow, like a super caramel albino, that might be interesting as well.
Wow. Eric,
those are all fun.
Get to work.
Yeah, all projects I'm working on.
He has everything to make these things, and just sitting there twiddling his thumbs, drawing in his big book. Anyway, I digress.
Let me get my quill pen out.
Yeah. Oh, quick, scratch that in. Anyway, now, Don, if you could have any other Morelia other than a carbon
rough
python,
scale python,
what would you have?
Rough scale python.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Okay. You and I are on the same page.
No, and you know what? I'm excited because they're out there. I've seen they're being imported into the U.S. They're legal. Guys are going to be breeding them soon. Most
cars people.
I want
my pair.
Yeah, I think it's going to be great. I think we're going to be able to get them soon. I think they'll be affordable in a number of few years. You know, I'm excited.
Mm-hmm.
I can't wait. Mm-hmm. I think can you believe those things were like nobody even knew they existed? So I don't know the exact numbers.
They're so. I absolutely love them. I don't know if it's just because I'm an insane person and I love the things that can bite me and that these things will actually show you the teeth. It's like, hey, these are going to be in your arm soon if you don't back the hell off. But they just seem so cool to me. So I'm definitely wanting some of them.
And I love the size part of it, that they're not a big species. That I just love. Mm-hmm. I'm not a fan of big stuff. I just love that. I they're awesome. You thought I was going to say bull and I or something, didn't you?
Yes, usually, normally it's like, you know, that question, it can go in many different directions. For some people are like, oh, kill for a helmet hair. Or it's really funny because the people, like the guys we've interviewed from Australia, is just like, oh, God, I would murder 8 people for a zebra. And I'm like, what, really? I have one.
Yeah, I know.
So it's again, you know, not really good.
Chondros are a big deal to the Aussies as well. They're pretty expensive, hard to come by. You know, down there you could probably trade chondros for several pairs of rough scales. You know.
Yeah, I know. And there's like albinos are like, you know, with your admission today to the reptile show, here's an albino carpet python. Oh, thank you.
I know. They've dropped. I know. I don't know if you've ever gone on the Australian forum. Have you ever looked at Australian classifieds?
Yeah.
No, I'd be sick.
Yeah. What's it called? Trade or something, I think? Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Amazing what stuff goes for. Some stuff's really cheap, and other stuff is crazily expensive. You're like, what the heck?
Yeah.
Yeah, the stuff that's
backwards. All right, so now, if you could have any non-Morelia, what would it be?
Well, I saw a picture of a black basin the other day that looked pretty cool, but no, I think... it's such a tough one. There's too many, but you know what is pretty would be pretty cool is an albino blackhead.
Oh yeah, I like those.
I don't know for sure if that would be my number one favorite, but it would depend on the day. I mean, I'm an addict like all of us, and I just want a bit of everything. You know, there's not. You know what I love is I love blood pythons too. I love that. What's that black and white blood? Magpie. That thing is so cool.
Oh, they're cool.
Yeah.
So many ball python things I'd love to get my hands on too. It's just, but I think an albino blackhead would be, I think that would be a pretty spectacular snake.
It would be cool.
No, something that, it would just, I don't know, pretty crazy.
I'm too nervous to look at, to deal with blackheads. You know, I tried breeding my Calkings and I'm like, please God, don't eat each other. Just don't eat each other. Blackheads, I'd be like, mother of God, don't even touch each other. Just somehow make babies without even looking. So.
I don't think that's really an issue with blackheads. I mean, again, I have not had a ton of experience. I have bred them only once. I've kept them for a number of years. My results were mixed, some good, some bad. But I tell you, I never had them try and hurt each other, ever.
Awesome. Okay, so maybe I'm blowing that one out of proportion.
Yeah, it's probably more to do with, you know, maybe, I guess in captivity they get enough food. They're not that hungry, you know.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So, now, what would be your most exciting project for 2013? Like, what's the most exciting project you have cooking for next season?
Well, probably for carpet pythons. It's not that amazing, but I was pretty excited with the results that Ollie made this year. I got myself in 2011, I bought a caramel head albino male.
Oh,
so
okay.
I'm hoping an 18-month-old male will breed a jag head albino female and make me hopefully a sunglow or in a magical dream hit the odds lottery ticket world. Maybe I could get a jag sunglow or sunglow jag.
Wow.
Cool.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool. So that could
awesome.
Be really interesting. Yeah. You know, so...
I have the same pairing, but the opposite. I got a jag head albino and a caramel head albino female.
Yeah, I noticed you had a caramel head albino female. That was a good pickup, man. That's going to come in handy because you didn't really know what you would get when they when you bought that, you had no idea what the result would be.
No. No, but I kind of thought it would be cool.
Yeah. Are you happy with the result? Oh, yeah. I guess we need to see the after shed picture, then it'll be even more exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can't imagine that it would not be cool. I mean...
I know, I'm with you. I'm with you, but you never know. Sometimes things you think will be so amazing are kind of like flop.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I hope not. That would just be horrible.
I kind of worry about that with, like, some of the projects that I'm into. It's like, you know, you're venturing into territory that you have no idea, you know, what's the end result going to be, but...
That's the fun of it, right?
Yeah.
Yep. It's that unknowing of, is it going to be look like crap or is it going to be amazing looking? You know, that's what makes it so exciting. That's a whole other side to this hobby, that it's just, you know, making animals that nobody else has seen, you know? And that, I know it's been said by all the guests on all the different shows and all the different internet, but it's true. You know, if you're kind of a nobody breeder and you've never really bred much, but you want to get some cool snakes and make an animal that no one in the world has ever made as far as multi-gene combination animals, you can do it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And it's pretty exciting. You know, it's I don't know. I think it's a pretty amazing hobby to get into.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty excited. Like this year, I think, and this is just, I don't know, I've only hatched out 3 clutches, so, but with my results that I've had from what my zebra jag looks like, my male zebra jag, I have another clutch that I hatched out where I got a zebra jag, and then I have a zebra jag that has tiger blood in it, and what it appears is that it sort of has banding like a Woma python.
Yeah.
And it appears that that's sort of what it did to the zebra jag. It's sort of like pinstripe ball python type of look.
Cool.
To the pattern. So I'm pretty excited to try to breed that back to a tiger and see if that is really what a zebra tiger jag looks like. So
reduce the pattern some more. Yeah,
that would be pretty cool. I know. There's so much neat stuff to make. Yeah, and some of those animals you know you're talking about, the ingredients aren't super expensive anymore, really, are they? Not, you know, like it's neat stuff you can get into.
Yeah, because I think like the pinstripe ball python is probably one of my favorite type of ball pythons, you know, and to recreate that into a carpet python is. It's pretty exciting for me. Anyway, so.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. No, I think you're 100% right. And a reduced pattern zebra or a reduced pattern zebra jag could definitely be on the way to doing that. You know,
sure, and then put Exanic in there or albino, and
A little caramel in there too. You know, sharpen up those things.
Yeah.
God,
no, it doesn't
stop
end.
Stop it, Dr. Frankenstein.
I know, it just doesn't end. It keeps going. And you know, it's interesting too that, you know, as we sort of talk about the carpet python, I think that as more interesting stuff gets made, that is going to increase people's interest in it. I mean,
right?
Yeah,
we've only sort of had a couple albino combinations. I think, you know, the jag was done a couple years ago. I think Paul did the zebra albino last year.
Right.
You know, the caramel albino, and you know, we're just sort of starting to scratch the surface a little bit on all the neat stuff that can be made. So, I think there's going to be a lot. I think it's more this. More of these combinations are done and people see, it's going to be like, wow, these things are gorgeous. And even albinos, I don't think most people have really seen how beautiful albinos are. I mean, I don't know how many you guys have seen, but they're each one is different, and they change so much from babies to adults. They go through crazy color changes as they mature. I can't believe what it's incredible. And some of the crosses too, the ones that have more IJ than pure Darwin have crazy patterns. There's all kinds of striping and peaches and orange coming out rather than just sort of a more banded.
Right.
It's amazing. They just change so much. I think as more and more people see this, it should get some interest going.
Yeah, I would agree. And they're so, you're absolutely right that they're so variable that,
they are.
You know.
Yeah.
None of them are going to be the same, you know, so that's cool.
No. I agree.
Somebody just sent me a picture of
holy crap, that's
a hypo brettle right from Australia.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Holy crap. Apparently they
sort
are
of a cream,
this
sort
of Australia.
It's a sort of a silvery white on like super orangey red, like just
Yeah,
that's gorgeous.
You know,
wow.
I often say that, you know, you look at jungle carpet pythons, and, you know, it's, I guess, because yellow and black snake, the contrast, and everybody loves it, and they've spent a lot of time, like, refining that, you know, and it's very cool. But I think of other carpet pythons, and, like, I think of a Brettle as a perfect example. Can you imagine what a Brettle's going to look like? Because there's not a whole lot of people that breed them as much as they breed jungles, but imagine refining that red. Like, we've refined the yellow in the jungle carp. You know what I mean?
Oh,
I know.
You've refined red in coastals. I mean, Luke has got great reds with his, and that's just through refining through a few generations. Start refining the Brettles even better and better and better. It's really going to start getting good.
Yeah.
Especially with the
maybe taking a caramel to a Brettle eye and then finding some extra red ones. I mean, who knows what's going to happen.
Eric can do that. I think I'd be wishing the whole time. No. But
I know you could see how many tangents you could go. I mean, before you know it, you'd have so many animals. You wouldn't. Oh my God! It's just so many
crazy,
interesting things to make. I know you really have to have sometimes control. You know, okay, let's try and concentrate on what makes sense for me to be working with. You know, because otherwise you'll have everything.
Yeah, that's my problem. I want everything.
You're not alone. You're not alone. Yeah. You're hardly the first or the last to have that. I think we're all guilty of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, we're winding down on time, and you know, it's.
Wow.
I appreciate you coming on, Don, and it's been a great show. And I just want to, before we cut off live, because we'll record a little bit after, but I wanted to make sure we get your website out there and all that stuff.
Thanks for having me on. This has been a blast. Time just flies by, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, dear God, yes.
Yeah, it always does. So what's your website?
Yeah, so my website is www.donpreptiles.com. And if anybody in the U.S. is ever interested in getting animals, I got a good buddy, Dale, in West Virginia, Vertical Reptiles. He helps me sell a lot of stuff down there.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah, you can contact. He's a good buddy of mine in the U.S., and I ship him stuff, and he helps send it out to people who want to get stuff. And, yeah, so you can check him out, or feel free to check my website out, or just send me an email. And I also help I usually get animals from Precision Reptiles, too, sometimes. So there's lots of ways. If people are interested in carpets, I can definitely help them get it to their door so they're not having to deal with brokers and customs and U.S. Fish and Wildlife and all that. It'll all be handled by me and sent to Dale and then get sent to the customer's door. So it works out great.
Cool.
Thank God for that.
Yeah, it's nice to have. I know. I get to do all the horrible legwork. Trust me, it's a long day.
And then we get to open up the box and see a sun glow carpet.
The people I've sent, the guys in the U.S., the customers in the U.S., I've sent animals to, customers of ours, you know, various people. If they knew all the hassle that I have in getting the animals or, you know, getting them once, then getting over the border with fish and wildlife, oh, God, it's such a pain in the butt. But, you know, that's the fun.
Yeah. So awesome.
That
awesome.
Is fun.
So, I guess, you know, whenever you, you're always welcome back, whenever you want to come in on.
Oh, absolutely. You know what? Anytime you need a guest. And I apologize about last time not being able to get on when I was supposed to. But anytime, feel free to contact me. And, I'm usually even last minute if there's any cool things you want to do a show on, something interesting, or multiple guests or whatever. Yeah, I'd love to. It'd be fun.
Okay. Awesome.
Awesome. Great. We always
Thanks again so much, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for coming on.
And keep up the work. I'm glad to know there's still some good reptile radio input on the Internet. I love it.
Well, you got to do something.
Yeah. Keep the word out. So.
Go Team Carpet, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Enough all this other crap, all these other stupid species. Okay, guys, thanks again.
All right.
Thanks
Don.
A lot, Don. Good night.
Bye-bye.
All right. Another awesome show, Owen. Seems like
we're
kind of on a roll, I think, you know? It's pretty cool.
See, now we're going to have a bad one because, you know, in a few shows, is my hostile takeover of Morelia Python Radio.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yeah. Is that next week?
No, the following week.
Thank God, because I still have no idea what I'm doing. You have to come down and show me what I'm doing.
I got to do that. That should be fun. I'm actually going to try to call in during that show and just say hello to you guys from sunny
Florida. I'll ignore your ass. I'll keep you on hold for the entire time. Eric's on hold, but we're not going to go to him.
So, yeah, that'll be cool. It'll be Luke's going to come on and...
Yeah, and Howard.
Should be
going to ruin... Yeah, I plan on opening the phone lines for anybody who wishes to call in and just say something. Please, go ahead. It's my hostile takeover from Rally Python Radio.
Awesome.
First person who utters maternal incubation gets cut off. Anyway.
Nice. So, next week we have Greg Stevens coming on. We met him at Carpet Fest, and he's the member I was telling you. He's pretty intense with how he keeps his collection, where he has his setup is pretty elaborate. He just sprays out each cage, and there's drainage system that goes
out.
It's pretty intense. Cool. So I'm looking forward to that show. We'll be talking chondros and getting the firsthand info from a guy that's pretty successful breeding them. So I'm looking forward to that. The only shout outs I have is Morelia Python's forum. Make sure you go over there, check it out. They're sponsoring the show. And I forgot to say that at the beginning of the show. Damn it.
Yep. Well, they're not going to be sponsoring us for much longer, so thank you very much for them sponsoring us for the two shows that we've done so far. Anyways.
Yeah. The website should be up and running now, www.moreliapythonradio.com. I'm tweaking that as we go through, but you can go over there and check it out. The domain is transferred now, and it should be live.
Awesome.
Go check that out. You can check us out on Facebook. You can download the show on iTunes. What else? Oh, yeah, and you can go sign up for Morelia Pick of the Week. Just go check out all those different things. Pretty much everything is there on the site. On www.moreliapythonradio.com. So go check it out, and that's all I got.
All right. For me, you can check out moreliapythonradio.com. It has pretty animals. All of Eric's animals. We're going to talk about this later.
Well, maybe
but
I took a picture.
We'll talk about this later. Anyways, it's a terrible picture of me. Holy crap. Anyway, moving on. I digress. Anyways, for me, you can check out Rogue Reptiles at RogueReptiles.com. Or sorry, Rogue-Reptiles.com. Also, you can look up Rogue-Reptiles on Facebook.com. Check out all the cool things. I promise, I will get pictures of the Carmel Tigers up. Please stop texting me at all hours of the night asking me if I put them up. I clearly haven't. Anyway, so hopefully we'll get those up soon. That's all I got.
Okay.
So, all right.
All right.
Have
so a good
I guess
night.
We'll check in next week and we'll see everybody then, and everybody have a good night.
All right.
Good night. From